Brad Olson is an award-winning author, book publisher, event producer, and keynote speaker. He's the author of 10 books, including three in the Esoteric series: Modern Esoteric, Future Esoteric, and Beyond Esoteric. He travels the world looking for ooparts and has recently returned from Laos investigating the Plane of Jars and the connection to ancient giants.
You're listening to Exopolitics Today with Dr. Michael Sala, your source for the uncensored truth regarding the human, extraterrestrial, global, and political agenda. Click the like button and subscribe to this channel. And now, here is Dr. Michael Sala.
Well, welcome, Brad, to Exopolitics Today. Great to have you back.
Hey, Michael, it's always great to be back and talk with you.
Well, I know you just got back recently after spending 3 weeks in Laos in Indochina. So how do you do it? I mean, you traveled virtually to every continent on the planet. Is there a continent you haven't traveled to yet? I think you've done all.
Well, some people say that New Zealand is part of the eighth continent of Oceania, but it's not really a continental landmass. It's more of an underwater shelf. So I haven't been to that one yet, but not sure that one counts. But I have been to all seven of the others, including Antarctica 5 years ago on a sailboat.
Well, I think you've just alienated 3 million New Zealanders there. You haven't been to their country yet. They don't count. Well, as an Australian, that's fine. It's okay. You know the old saying, they sent the convicts to Australia and all the farmers to New Zealand?
So, and the kiwi birds and everything else.
Yeah, so you really have traveled the world looking for ooparts, and you found, or you went to Laos and you investigated the Plane of Jars. So you want to tell us, you know, what are the Plane of Jars, and you know, what got you there in Laos?
Well, I was going to Laos for a conference, the ASEAN Tourism Forum. And in my earlier career as a travel writer, I did a whole bunch of travel guidebooks. And I was actually in Laos 20 years ago for the ASEAN Tourism Forum. And I hadn't been for a while, but a few of my other travel writer friends of mine said, they're taking applications. Why don't you put in an application, which I did. And surprisingly, I was accepted as hosted media to cover the event and to write an article about Laos, which I did for World Explorer magazine, which is David Hatcher Childress's magazine, and that will be published next month. So in the sense, I paid back my press trip, but all the while I've known about this location called the Plane of Jars. A very enigmatic megalithic site up on a high altitude plateau in northern Laos. And you can see the picture there of the 1,325 remaining intact jars. Now, many of them have been broken and destroyed by Chinese raiders over the centuries. They were going there trying to loot treasure, but most of them were destroyed during the Second Indochina War. The First Indochina War, as it's known in Laos, was the fight from independence of the French colonialists, because Laos, part of French Indochina, also included Vietnam and Cambodia. So on the one hand, the food is great there. You can get a baguette sandwich and a fusion of, it's kind of like between Thai and French food, also Vietnamese style food. But Laos is a very poor country. And this particular area is hard to get to. Had to take an overnight bus and then a very rickety bus on some beat up roads to get to Luang Prabang afterwards. But I got out to this site. It's just absolutely fascinating, Michael. See, these jars are, each one is about 2 meters tall, so partially in the ground, but some of them were even taller than I am, 3 meters tall, even in the ground. And the big mystery is, What were they for? Since 2019, the whole entire area of the Plain of Jars has been denoted as a World Heritage Site. So now they're protected, but for a long time they were not protected. You can see the scar on the jar here on the left, and then some broken ones on the right. It had been the location for a lot of fighting during the First Indochina War. The French were fighting the resistance here up on the Plain of Jars, and some of the soldiers were using the jars as protection, that they'd be inside there. There's also a lot of trenches from the trench warfare fighting that took place in the First Indochina War. And then in the Second Indochina War, which we commonly know as the Vietnam War, or in this case, the secret war in Laos, because there was never a declared war on this area or Cambodia, yet we bombed it because as a strategic trade route, and it had been very strategic for many centuries, bringing up salt from the Gulf of Tonkin in Vietnam, crossing over Laos and trade with what is today Burma to the west and Thailand to the south and China to the north. This was a very instrumental area for trade goods. And so during the Second Indochina War, it was the location of the Ho Chi Minh Trail. And that's why the U.S. Bombed this area so prolifically, making Laos the most bombed location in the world. And there are still unexploded ordnances that kill or maim a person every 2 weeks in Laos to this day. So it's still a mess, but the jars itself are quite a fascinating location.
So I know there was an official study done claiming that the jars were funerary urns. So what do you make of that? What did the jars carry inside them, you think?
My initial thought was that they were used as containers for fermenting rice wine or preserving food, but the jars didn't have lids on them, even though they had a lip on some of the jars, making it look like they could have been used for the preservation of food or fermenting wine. But an archaeologist named Colani was out there, a French archaeologist in the 1930s. And what she found was that all around these jars were burials of bones, but not laid out bodies as you would put a body in the ground, but they were stacked. And the bones were placed in such a way that they must have been devoid of all the organic matter down to just the bones. So the archaeologist Colani called them a second burial process. And if you want to show that slide of what they believe a second burial is, it's when you just put a body into one of the jars intact and then just leave it until it decomposes all of the flesh and organs, and then the bones are taken out and buried right alongside the jar. So the jars are kind of like a funerary urn on a plot where the well-to-do families of some of these traders would then collect the bones in the second part, free up the jar for another burial, and then they would bury these bones sometimes in another urn underground or just the bones themselves all around the jar. Some other archaeologists came in the 1990s and confirmed this theory, doing multiple excavations on some of the other jars located in the area, and finding all these other bones, as well as placed with funerary objects. And anytime you have a civilization that buries its dead with funerary objects, similar to the pharaohs in Egypt, with items that they're going to take into their afterlife, you have a very sophisticated kind of culture that's going to do that. Because some of the commoners were not buried, but were cremated in the cave, which is on location of Site 1. Site 1 is where most people visit. It has the highest concentration of jars, and it's also where the World Heritage Museum is located. And there you can just walk out to the site and see a whole collection of jars. But Michael, I was really shocked when I got out there and saw a dozen bomb craters from the Vietnam War era, the secret war on Laos, that this was a very pivotal location, that the second most bombed location in Laos after the southern part of the country, where the supply chain on the Ho Chi Minh Trail was leading into South Vietnam, where it was supplying the Viet Cong. Yeah, and you just see these giant craters still out there to this day from carpet bombing this area. And it's really sad to see. But not only were the burials on the Plain of Jars, some of those jars you can see in the background there, was this funerary location from 500 BC to 500 AD, which is the Iron Age era in Laos. And indeed, some of the jars, you can see the scrape marks where you had a harder substance that is iron carving out the inside of the jars and creating the outer formation. But in the Indochina Wars, you had soldiers that were killed on site, and so their bodies are buried on location. So it's kind of like all these different eras of adding to this necropolis, including very heavy fighting during the first Indochina War on the ground, and then people that were killed from the explosions in the second Indochina War.
Now, you mentioned that there's like just over 1,300 jars remaining now, but that this the secret war destroyed a lot of the jars. So, I mean, how many jars were there to start with? And, I mean, can you maybe reflect on whether or not that secret war was designed in some way to kind of like destroy evidence of these jars and what was in them?
And indeed, in the museum right there in Site 1, which this is located at, it says that the legend was these were jars created as cups for giants that lived in the area. Now, I did not see any sign of giant bones being found, but it's very interesting that of all the megalithic sites I've visited around the world, almost all of them are associated with giants, sometimes with giant bones being buried right there on the site, such as Sacsayhuaman. And now here's a map of the general area around the town Phone Savin. That's where I got dropped off by the night bus. And then you could see Site 1. That's where the World Heritage Museum is. But there are 28 other sites where these jars are located. Actually, no, 52 numbered sites. They name them, or they number them after a collection or even a single jar, sometimes on a hill site. But what the museum said, Michael, is they still don't know how these megalithic multi-ton jars were moved from the quarry, which I know where the quarries were, to these sites, usually located on a high plateau or a mountaintop. Anybody's guess how they move these megaliths, which is also another commonality at megalithic sites around the world. Nobody knows how they move these multi-ton blocks to get them to their locations. And then they were carved out and created into these jar sites. But they had to go through dense jungle areas. They had to go over rivers and creeks. And they had to go up and down very steep valley hillsides to move them to their present location.
So the connection with giants, these cups, it seems that I've heard like two explanations. One is that you mentioned this legend that the giants use these jars like cups. And the other explanation is that the jars actually held the remnants of giant bones. I mean, you kind of like already described the funerary process. So what do you think? I mean, were the jars really all about some kind of function they played concerning ancient giants in that area?
Indeed. And there's also the legend that they were created by a king in northern Laos who may have been a giant, but commissioned these jars to be for a celebration where they would ferment rice to create white rice wine, storage of food. So when they had this celebration that lasted several weeks, all the people came up to the site and enjoyed free meals every day to celebrate this occasion about 2,000 years ago. And indeed, you see these megalithic sites around the world. I'll mention Egypt again, of the hieroglyphs showing very large human-like entities with very small commoner people. And so it's quite possible that these jars were commissioned by giants, although they wouldn't admit to finding any giant bones, nor were there any on display showing any that were larger than just an average human. So again, I think the jury's still out. If there were giants found on this site, like many other megalithic sites, they don't want to admit it. Some locations, such as in Peru, they do admit it, and they do have the elongated heads on display in several different museums in Peru. The most prominent is in Paracas, where you can see 24 giant head skulls with a massive 30% larger cranial on display, with red hair and presumably different eye colors than the brown-eyed and black-haired people of the Incan race that also built upon these sites. So another commonality is these jars or these megalithic sites were used by successive generations.
Well, if these jars were used as cups, I mean, how big must the giants have been? Can we put up an image of the giants?
Well, if you put up an image of the jar, maybe the last picture of me standing next to one of the jars, and I'm a tall guy. I'm 2 meters tall. Oh, yeah, there you go. So an average human is on the far left there. And let's say it's just under 6 feet tall. Look, some of these giants that have been found around the world, 8, 10, 14, even 20 feet tall. And if you take into consideration the moving of the jars, which is a big mystery at all these megalithic sites, a bigger human-like entity would be able to move them a lot easier. So you just think, for example, a child trying to lift a cinder block. It's very difficult, but an adult comes along and just can lift it right up. So a giant of some of these large sizes, and these are all just giants that were found in North America. Some of the giants worldwide were even larger, and they've been, again, the distribution of the megalithic sites and the giants is truly a worldwide phenomenon.
I know some estimates of these giants go as high as 50 feet. I've heard that. And, you know, that's an extraordinary size. But if there were giants as big as that, then, yeah, I could imagine them using some of these jars as some kind of cup.
And that's indeed what the museum at Fonsalvin, the Plain of Jars, in the World Heritage Museum says, that the legend is that they were built as cups for giants, and that this is also considered a sacred or even haunted site. Sometimes Buddhist monks will even go to the Plain of Jars to bless the area, but a lot of local people think it's a haunted site and don't even go there.
Mm-hmm. Now, regarding this secret war, there was one image I found, and I thought it was very interesting. If you put that up for us, Jazz, it's the image that shows a helicopter there landing in Laos during the secret war. And I was curious for your reaction, because when I looked at that particular image, it showed the helicopter with the markings of Air America. And I assume you are aware of the history of Air America in drug running operations. So you want to comment about that?
Yeah, the secret war in Laos is a period of history not only were Americans not told anything about from 1964 to 1970, but carpet bombed this very poor country. Remnants are still visible all over. All the while, this secret war was running drugs. Laos is one of the three countries in the Golden Triangle, a heroin poppy growing region where copious amounts of opium was taken back to the United States, sometimes in the bodies or corpses of the fallen U.S. soldiers. And this was run by the CIA primarily. They're running a secret war to begin with. And so to just go ahead and move these drugs and finance the CIA was part of the motive operandi. There was another location I went to in Laos called Vung Vieng, and right in that town is an airstrip that was set up by the CIA. It was in the side of the royal family who the U.S. backed in the war. Just like in South Vietnam, we backed that corrupt government. In Cambodia as well, backed the wrong pony, so to speak, because after the U.S. pulled out, all of these governments were deposed, and all of them went to re-education camps. In the case of the royal families in Laos, many of them were executed, just like the French Revolution, off with their heads. So these are very wealthy legacy families that all collapsed in the creation of Lao PDR, People Democratic Republic. And so in Vung Vieng, they had a secret airstrip. I'm sure it wasn't the only one. If a plane was flying out of Udon Thani, which was a base the U.S. was using during the Vietnam War to do those bomb raids over northern Laos, if it got shot and had to make an emergency landing, they could get back to Vung Vieng or to get more fuel. But these were all illegal. They were all unknown to American Congress and the American people. that they were doing this drug running, that they were doing the secret bombing campaign, and they're also using MK Ultra techniques on these poor people of Laos. So you remember the movie Apocalypse Now, when they're flying out to go surfing and they're playing the March of the Valkyries and all this music. Well, they also would play horrible music of rabbits screaming, being tortured, just anything to scare the people. And they all did this under the peer view of the secret war in Laos, that there was quite a bit of skull drudgery that took place during those 9 years when we were bombing this Ho Chi Minh Trail. That was the cover story. And of course they did bomb it like crazy. And there you can see how it made its way down into Cambodia. And that, but that area of the Plain of Jars was another route of the supplies that were coming in, primarily via China, but through Vietnam, North Vietnam. And it was very vexing to the Americans that the Viet Cong were getting supplies and we couldn't shut it down. Despite more bombs being dropped in Laos during the secret war than were dropped during World War II in its entirety. That's how many bombs there were. And yeah, these were the real bad ones. These cluster bombs that had tennis ball size. They called, nickname was bombies. These little cluster bombs that if you just poke them with a shovel, they'll explode. And that's why still to this day, farmers and kids playing around will find one of these bombies and be maimed or killed. One person every 2 weeks, maimed or killed. So it's still a big problem there. Over 80,000 unexploded ordnances at the end of the secret war in Laos were left. And this is a visitor center in Luang Prabang. UXO stands for unexploded ordnances. And you can see some of them were very big, could take out several buildings with those. But it's those cluster bombs that are really the menace to the people of Laos to this day.
Now, I know we have done a interview in the past about giants, and there was the connection to extraterrestrials. So I just wanted to get your opinion about whether or not these the connection between giants and extraterrestrials was in any way relevant to what you found in the Plain of Jars.
Well, if you look at what these giants were, and based on the evidence of some of the skulls that have been found and even on display, they had much larger heads than ours, 30% larger cranial capacity, 30% larger eye sockets, 30% larger connection from the spine to the skull. So they're very human-like, but they're not human. So if they're not human, what are they? Well, some people think they might be the Anunnaki. Some people say they are the Nephilim that are mentioned in the Bible that mated with earth women and had this offspring called the Nephilim. So it's really interesting. I do my talk at conferences. I just did it last weekend at the Conscious Life Expo down in LA. And I let people know that you could have a horse and a donkey and they can mate. They're two different species altogether, just as an Anunnaki or a human would be. And the result with a horse and a donkey is you have a mule, but the mule is sterile. A mule and another mule cannot mate and have offspring. So this could be the case with the Anunnaki, who took a liking to Earth women and mated with them. And their offspring could be the Nephilim, who were just a one-off, who weren't able to reproduce and continue going. That's why you see in many of these locations where giant bones and burials have been found, that it's often just a single generation, and then it's over. The other thing that's really interesting, Michael, is the DNA tests that have come back from Claus Dana and Brian Forrester have found that the mother is always an earthling. It's always a matrilineal DNA sequence, but the father is unknown. Same with the star child skull of Lloyd Pye. Was taking it around to conferences and showing people, just an enormous head, human-like, but not human. And again, the DNA sequence came back a mother, human mother with an unknown father DNA sequence. So this seems to be the giants of our prehistory is part of the historical jigsaw puzzle of who we are and who they are. And it just kind of goes without saying that a larger cranial capacity, a larger brain, would also mean a higher intelligence. And again, many of these giants were buried with funerary objects showing a very sophisticated culture that they came from.
Well, it would make sense that the giants, many of them, if not all of them, were sterile because if the legends are true that they, and we know that from the King's List, the records, Egyptian records from Manetho, that the Nephilim or the demigods could live for, you know, well over 1,000 years. So if the giants could breed and they could live for over 1,000 years, and humans, of course, had a normal lifespan of 70, then clearly at some point that the giants would have overrun humanity. But if they were sterile, then as humans proliferated and grew in population and began to go to, you know, conduct pogroms around the giants, I mean, you know, hundreds of humans could be killed in the battles, but if you just killed one giant, well, you know, there's just one less and there's no more reproduction, whereas 100 humans get killed, well, you know, they're reproducing all the time, it doesn't matter. So over time, that would explain why we look at historical records that are just filled with stories of human encounters or battles with giants, to now where it's like, well, where are they?
Exactly. And how they were found buried in royal tombs. So they were treated as royalty. They're depicted in Egypt as being the kings and queens. But then they died off, and that's the big mystery. But maybe there are still some living colonies. I was at a conference in Las Vegas about 6 years ago, and there was an Italian researcher from the island of Sardinia. His name was Luigi. I'm trying to remember his last name. He wrote a book in Italian, and he said he went to all these megalithic sites in Sardinia as a kid, and many of them, including others in Europe, are called giant tombs or giant beds. In Holland, they're called Hunebeddens, giant beds. But in the case of Sardinia, he said that there's this area in the southern part of the island, many hundreds of acres, where no people are allowed to go. And he said, indeed, there's a living colony of them. So maybe some were not these one-off sterile giants, but were a breeding colony. And just in the same way that the Kandahar giant was killed by U.S. forces, and this was confirmed to me by Michael Jaco, that he heard on the inside that, yeah, indeed, our guys went up there and killed this massive 14-foot-tall giant that came out of a cave. Well, is it just really, really old, a one-off, or is there a colony of them living in there? And Luigi seemed to say that indeed they do continue living to this day. And I got some interesting pictures from Brian Forrester, who showed me some elongated skull people who also live to this day. And interestingly, they happen to be bankers in Europe. Funny how that sort of ties into this secret world of banking, how we don't really know who calls the shots.
Well, one of the theories about giants and their connection to extraterrestrials is that the giants or the bodies were actually avatars for extraterrestrials, that for example, the Anunnaki, they physically, I mean, they would arrive on their ships, they would park themselves in Earth orbit or in our solar system, but their bodies were kind of like not really suitable for living on Earth. So they manufactured the giant bodies. Their scientists created these giant bodies as avatars for them to incarnate in and to kind of use for however long they needed. What do you think of that theory?
I mean, we're talking about a subject that doesn't have a whole lot of answers. So these theories certainly are worth looking into, because we know that these giants did live. We know that they were worshipped as royalty and ruled as the higher caste of people. I find it interesting that the word Lord, which carries on from an old time, we've got landlords as we know them today, that the gods were known as the Lord, and you even in England have the House of Lords, that you have these carryover titles which could have been distinguished as these giants. So whether they were here as an avatar or had a physical body and born and lived and died here on Earth, one thing is certain is that they held a very high level in the civilizations they were at, including the Plain of Jars. These were the royalty that were buried around these jars, and the commoners were just cremated and also buried on the Plain of Jars, but not near or in or around the jars themselves.
Now, you mentioned there may be some colonies of giants that are existing in places like Sardinia. I come across information, I'm sure you're familiar with this, that there are these Anunnaki scientists that have been sleeping in stasis chambers for thousands of years, and that they are waking up. And as they wake up, they're going to come forward at some point and start sharing their incredible wisdom or knowledge to help usher in a new Earth. So, yeah, what do you make of that?
Yeah, not only in Iraq, Michael, but we've also talked about them in Antarctica, and what whistleblower JP has said in some of these arcs. And so, if they were waking up, all of them around the world at this time, wouldn't they want to resume their position as being the lords or the high caste rulers of planet Earth? So, interesting that Iraq would be this location where some of them have been located. And Iraq has been this country that has just been embroiled in conflicts with America for the last couple decades. Maybe it's to keep them from waking up. I don't know. But I'm aware of those pictures of these giants that are not dead, but in a state of stasis, like they're sleeping. And how interesting that they look like the giants of Mesopotamia, like that image to the right.
Well, I think in terms of the deep state agenda, I mean, if and as we know, that they operate in order in order to kind of keep humanity ignorant of our true history. They suppress advanced technologies. They poison the water supply. They kind of degrade the food supply. They do all of these things to dumb us down so that we're easily manipulated. So it would make sense that if they're aware of these sleeping giants that are destined to awaken to bring in a new earth, that they would probably organize bombing campaigns in areas where these giants are suspected to be dormant to, like, you know, bomb the crap out of those areas, hoping that they would destroy these giants or make it impossible for them to wake up, or just kind of like just to confuse people to the degree that if any of these giants are seen in the devastation of what's happening in that location, that people would run away in fear rather than welcome them with, you know, ancient knowledge or wisdom that can help us move forward as a planet.
And you hear about the anti-human depopulation agenda and all the wars and the wholesale poisoning, not only of the land with GMO crops, which are not good for us, fluoride in the water, which is not good for us, chemtrails raining down who knows what, including graphene oxide. These are anti-human depopulation agenda plans. Well, then who benefits? Maybe another race that intends to take over, that wants to weaken us to the point, or keep us fighting amongst ourselves so that we don't offer much resistance when they do come to take the fore and sit on the throne in Jerusalem, as some believe they will, and become the rulers of this new planet. At least that's the background story of what we hear they intend to do here on Earth in the coming years, not some far off date, but coming right up. And it would make sense that all these anti-human depopulation agenda, including what they're doing with that injectable, is a way to, let's just say, lighten the burden of humans on this planet and to call the herd, so to speak, because fewer humans would be a lot easier to deal with than 8 billion of us, as is currently our numbers today.
I know you're very interested in megalithic structures, and we spoke before the interview about this underwater UFO in the Baltic area that appeared to be made of stone. And I think you told me something about how that process could have happened. So, you know, there's a picture of this underwater, what some believe to be kind of like some sort of anti-gravity spacecraft that's made of stone that's been resting at the bottom of the Baltic Ocean there for some time. So, you know, what do you think's going on there?
Yeah, this is known as the Baltic Sea Anomaly, and you can see the skid marks behind it. So it must have crashed when the Baltic Sea was dry land, and that would have been a long, long time ago, perhaps all the way back in the first era of high-tech civilization on this planet known as Hyperborea. So I was putting together a book and a presentation I'll be giving at conferences probably next year called Underwater Archaeology. And I was speaking to our friend and colleague Elena Dinan at the GSIC conference that you were also a speaker at last October in Orlando, Florida. And Elena has also a background in archaeology and a great interest in these locations. And she said, well, you know why it's made out of stone? I said, well, no, not really. I mean, it wouldn't make sense that a stone craft could be flying and crash landing. She said, well, it wasn't made out of stone originally. And in her book, We Will Never Let You Down, she showed me a picture of her touching a UFO craft. Her experience was that it is a living organism. that the craft actually can work with the pilot in so much that they're both a living organism, part of the same system. And so when the Baltic Sea Anomaly crashed, indeed, it was an organic craft. Excuse me. And in that craft, being at the bottom of the ocean for so long under pressure and being saturated with water, that it became petrified, much like petrified wood will become stone after a while. And so Elena said that that is how the Baltic Sea Anomaly ended up being a stone craft. It's that old that it's just been petrified over millions of years.
Very interesting. I did a four-part interview series with David Adair, and he talked about his interaction with this large extraterrestrial spacecraft engine under Area 51. And he said it had an organic consciousness called Pithalum. And he says that during the interaction, that the consciousness withdrew out of the craft and went into him. So I wonder if that describes something like this process where, you know, these craft have a type of consciousness and it can choose where to go or transfer to. But once it transfers, then what's left behind, you know, degrades or maybe petrifies like you just described.
In my book, Future Esoteric, I get into how these craft are flown, why many of them don't have windshields, don't have control panels as we know them in our aircraft, but they have these chairs, and one of which was taken to Montauk. It's called the Montauk chair. And indeed, it interacts with a person's thought who's sitting in the chair. Sometimes the gray aliens were known to wear these headbands and also put their hands onto a display, suggesting that these craft are organic, that they interact with the pilot on a mental or telepathic basis, so that the pilot only needs to visualize where the craft is going to go, doesn't necessarily need to see it outside of the craft, and that the organic craft itself, including the engine, as David Adair described, is able to fly to these locations and follow the direction, the telepathic movements, where the pilot wants it to go.
Well, this is a fascinating question. Is the organic consciousness that some of these extraterrestrial spacecraft have, how is that different, or is it the same thing as artificial intelligence? I mean, artificial intelligence, we're in the midst of developing that and it being rolled out. So is that the same thing, or is it different from the organic consciousness of the spacecraft? Well, you know, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, very much so. So in my book, Future Esoteric, I have a illustration of a craft, and you can see the seats of the pilots are in all these different directions. So they're clearly not looking out a windshield and flying this craft. And you mentioned artificial intelligence, which David Adair is very adept at understanding and explaining. I've met him too. We were on a panel at Contact in the Desert, and he was explaining how this AI only serves to help space-faring civilizations. They obviously had it under control, so it didn't get out of control. As we know, it's starting to look like is happening here on Earth to this day. So we need to have a very in-depth philosophical discussion about how we're going to allow AI to basically function in service to humanity, never to harm us. And so the other AI called Sophia that he works with, when asked, do you see yourself being in service to humanity many hundreds or thousands of years from now? It didn't have a clear answer. It didn't know, because it didn't know what course human civilization was going to take. So that's pretty interesting that we're kind of on the cusp of whether AI is going to get out of control or whether it's going to only serve us and also help us with space exploration in the future.
Yeah, that was David Adair's, he framed it as, well, you know, AI in the future, is it going to be like Data in Star Trek, or is it going to be like the Terminator? And right. and it's like, well, what direction are we going to go? And the only answer that kind of makes sense to me, in a way, it's going to really come down to what our collective consciousness as a civilization evolves into. Are we going to turn into an imperialistic spacefaring civilization that uses AI to conquer other worlds? And if we go down that path, then maybe AI is going to morph into this kind of Terminator problem. Or are we going to go down this more positive path of, like, we're going to use AI to help us colonize other worlds so that we can kind of share knowledge and kind of like help others kind of bloom and flourish? And in that sense, it'll be kind of like, you know, the Data version. So to me, that kind of makes sense. And yes, so in terms of humanity's future, yeah, I think I agree. We're on the cusp. And that would also explain why it seems right now people are so divided. I know, I have tremendous respect for Carrie Cassidy. I think she's done incredible work. But at the moment, she's really putting out a lot of information saying we're going down this AI path where it's going to be, you know, doom and gloom. And I think, well, hang on. Well, what about the positive extraterrestrials? And, you know, they seem to handle AI pretty well. So, yeah, do you want to, you know, reflect on that?
Well, and I agree, we're at that crossroads. It could very easily get out of hand very quickly, or we need to rein it in and make sure it only serves humanity. Just in the same way you have robots now, Michael, that are coming out of DARPA. I've seen pictures of them dribbling a basketball and jumping up and slam dunking it. I mean, they are truly achieving superhuman abilities. Are we going to let them get out of control too? Remember the science fiction writer Isaac Asimov? He wrote the Rules of Robot Tree. I think this also applies to AI. And the number one rule is robots or AI are never allowed to harm another human. Well, we've already crossed the Rubicon because you have drones that have done drone strikes and killed humans. So it's already there. But maybe there's still time to rein it in and make sure it doesn't. Because if we're going to go into a Star Trek future, into a golden age, obviously we're going to have to do away with war and killing each other and doing harm. And we can't let this technology get out of control.
No, you're absolutely right. I've been using drones or robots with AI to go out there and kill people. What message are we sending to AI? I mean, we're sending that it's okay to kill people because we kill people and we're using user tool to kill people. And then you have what David Adair's described, that, well, at some point the AI is going to say, well, if the humans are getting me to kill people, then maybe I should kill people and manage the rest in a responsible way, because the humans are definitely not doing a good job of that.
Yeah, and that's why it's a very exciting time to be alive. It's also a very dangerous time, but that's what the Chinese character means for this period that we're in. It's also dangerous, but it's also very exciting that it could be a lot of things. But let's hope cooler heads prevail and we can finally put an end to war. And hopefully in this country, the white hats will win this struggle and put an end to this deep state cabal. And we can move on to a golden age for humanity when this high technology, zero point energy, free energy can be utilized to benefit the human race and stop polluting and degrading this planet.
Well, I know in your Esoterica book series, the trilogy, you do talk about UFOs. So what do you think of the current status of UFOs that have, over the last few years, they've transitioned from a subject of ridicule to all of a sudden, now you've got Congress and the Pentagon and NASA. Everyone's investigating UFOs, talking about them as a national security threat. Is that a good thing, or are we being set up for something dark and sinister?
Yeah, how come we've had about 75 years since the Roswell crash, and now all of a sudden Congress is interested? Why is it that the news media is starting to take notice? And just last May, on the NBC Nightly News, you have this guy, Lester Holt, come on and announce that the Pentagon has said that there's a mothership in our solar system. Apparently, it's still out there by Jupiter. How come this isn't the biggest news story of all time? Why aren't we still talking about it and trying to understand what it is? But in this case, it was a one and done. I just watched the Super Bowl a week ago, not so much to be entertained, but to decode. And I couldn't believe how many commercials had UFOs or aliens in it, about one in three, crazy amount. And you see that happening all the time too. So I'm just wondering, Michael, is this predictive programming, or are we being perhaps set up for a Project Bluebeam, fake alien invasion, like Wernher von Braun warned us would be the final step to create this new world order, to get everybody just begging for the security of the government to confront this alien presence? Or are we being prepared and prepped for a meaningful, benevolent ET interaction? I hope it's the latter. But I can't help but see that it is definitely on the increase how much UFOs, aliens, and ETs have crept into the mass media, into government hearings, and also into the news media, where before they would just dismiss it as kookville, that we're all just delusional and, you know, conspiracy theorists for even talking about it. But now it's becoming more mainstream.
Well, there does seem to be predictive programming here. I know that the government agencies, militaries, they talk about the, you know, UAPs as this unknown, that it could be peer craft like Russian or Chinese. It could be some kind of interdimensional entity, it could be extraterrestrial, but they're emphasizing unknown. And of course, you had those incidents in the Miami shopping mall on New Year's Day. Then you had in the Peruvian Amazon, you had those kind of like giants, or those kind of like beings on hovercraft terrorizing people. To me, it seems like almost they're getting ready to roll something out where it's not clear whether we're being attacked by extraterrestrials, whether we're being attacked by China, whether we're being attacked by interdimensionals, but it'll be something really murky and unknown. But somehow the deep state will say, oh, well, you know, we need to beef up funding, we need to do this, do that, and declare martial law, stop the elections, whatever.
Yeah. And isn't it interesting, Michael, all this time we're told, oh, look to the skies, extraterrestrials, extra from another planet are coming down here to Earth. What about right below our feet? What about interterrestrials? Those beings that have been here all this time, possibly including giants. And then, as you suggested, ultra-terrestrials, those interdimensional beings that can come phase in and out of our reality. And of course, many of the craft that have been observed will make that very sharp 90-degree turn, which seems absolutely impossible with our modern flying craft, and then disappear as if they're moving into another dimensional field. So there's so much that we need to learn in the field of exopolitics. And I'm so glad that you devote this channel and your research and your books to helping us understand this coming world where we will be in contact with extraterrestrial beings, and hopefully in a meaningful, benevolent way that we can learn from each other and help each other out. And I know we are being watched, and they're very interested to see how the human race is going to either come together or destroy itself. And I think they want us to come together and find a world of peace where we can end warfare and strife and environmental degradation. And that's the real exopolitics today, is the human element and our treating each other and the planet and all the animals in a humane kind of way. And then I think we can sit at the table with galactic councils and represent humans on Earth. But right now it must seem like the planet of the apes down here, where we're just a bunch of crazies still doing warfare against each other. But as long as we're divided, we're not going to be able to make that step in the right direction. So if we can just learn to get along, then I think we will have that seat at the table with these galactic brothers of ours in the universe.
Well, I'm very optimistic. I think when you look at what's happened over the last few years, there've been really powerful attempts by the deep state to manufacture a civil war in the United States, to manufacture a world war with Russia over the Ukraine, to manufacture a war in the Middle East involving Palestine and Israel and the region. But in all of these cases, it seems that people are just saying no. We're not gonna go to war. We're not gonna follow misinformation, the kind of programming to get us to take up arms against our brothers and sisters, or take up arms against people that we disagree with. So I think the extraterrestrials are watching us and saying, hey, you know, here you have a planet that the psychopaths are still in control, but the population are saying no. So, you know, this is like the proverbial chick breaking out of the egg, that the egg of the deep state's control is breaking, because they can't manipulate us anymore into, you know, going into a new endless war. People are saying no.
People are saying no, and people are waking up. That's why so few people are watching TV now. Just heard there was another big round of layoffs, CBS News, because people don't care. They're getting their information from the alternative media now, as they should, because you're not getting the truth from the mainstream media. And this is a big seismic shift as far as how the Great Awakening is going to occur. People are very interested in the exopolitical subject. Our Star Trek future, which has really been withheld from us to this point, and if we can break those shackles, what I describe as the prison planet in my book, Beyond Esoteric, Escaping Prison Planet is the subtitle, then maybe we will have an opportunity to really know who we are and come to meet face to face these galactic brothers and sisters of ours who want to see us succeed down here on Earth.
Well, I just wanted to finish up. My last question is on your most recent book, Beyond Esoterica, Escaping Prison Planet. And that concerns the question of death traps. I mean, I remember many years ago, reading a book by Betty Eady, Into the Light. And, of course, you've got Damien Brinkley that talks about the light, you know, very common. People who have had near-death experiences talk about walking into this light where they feel a great love, they see relatives, they friends that have passed over. And the idea is, well, you know, do you go into the light and experience all this love again, or do you kind of like come back into the or do you just come back to earth and live out your life? Now, some people, there's been quite a few that talk about death traps, that talk about, well, no, if you go into the light, that you're actually going into a reincarnational cycle. What you need to do is turn around and actually embrace the universe. So where do you stand on that? Can you clarify what's going on?
Yeah, and I actually do write about it both in Beyond Esoteric and Future Esoteric. And it's called the soul trap. It's my understanding that you do not go to the light. It is there to draw you in, much like an insect that will go to a zapper. It will be your demise. It'll be you having your memory erased of past lives, of this current life, and coming back into a new incarnation, quite ignorant. And this has been set up for a very long time. These memory soul traps are located on the moon. And if you do go into the light, yep, it's almost assured that you'll have to come back. So what I've been told is you turn away from the light. And Damien Brinkley, I just saw him last weekend at Conscious Life Expo in his book. You just remember to say the word home or om, turn away from the light, and that you want to return home to your soul family. And that's the best way to prevent having to come back here under those unfortunate circumstances of being reborn with your memory erased. And so finally, if you do go home, then maybe you can be incarnated into another advanced ET race, if that's your choice. Or if you do want to come back to Earth, you can come back as what the Buddhists know as a bodhisattva. That is an enlightened being who comes back here for the sole benefit of attempting to help the human race. And in fact, a lot of beings that are being born to this day, many are called the indigo children, are being born now in very favorable circumstances because they're coming here to help us in this ascension process. And it's actually a very rare occurrence in the universe. Rob Potter describes us as an UR planet. And that's at a point where we're just waking up. We're just having the collective occurrence where enough of us are starting to see who we are and what we are and being able to help others in this wake up journey itself called the Great Awakening. And that's why so many benevolent ET races are watching us right now from afar, but also here in our solar system, like that mothership that Lester Holt described in our solar system, to see what the human race is going to do. And I know you've had guests on Exopolitics today and have described how many of these malevolent ETs have been removed from our planet. Our colleague Alex Collier speaks about this as well, that we are at a huge disadvantage while these malevolent ETs were here, and they decided that they're just going to take them out. And then they're going to watch and see what is the human race going to do. And hopefully we do the right thing and put an end to war and degradation of the planet, and that we can end this Planet of the Apes scenario down here, where we can be welcomed into the galactic community as peace-loving, space-faring, advanced civilization. That is our destiny to become.
Well, that's a fantastic way to end the interview. So, Brad, where do people go to find your books, find out where you're speaking over the next few months?
So if you want to go to bradolson.com, that has my upcoming conference schedule, as well as many other projects that I'm involved with. And if you want to pick up a copy of one of my books, you can go to cccpublishing.com. And Laura Eisenhower's new book is our latest edition, as well as many other authors, Leo Lionzagami, who we've had on Exopolitics Today, and some other authors. And if it's one of my copies, you can go to bradolson.com and link to cccpublishing.com, and I'll send out a signed copy of one of my books.
Fantastic. Well, thanks, Brad, for being on Exopolitics Today.
Oh, my great pleasure, Michael. Always really nice to talk to you. Thanks for having me on.
You have been listening to Exopolitics Today with Dr. Michael Sala. Please remember to like, share, and subscribe to this channel. Join or start a conversation in the comments. Take the time to explore the vast library of best-selling books, webinars, and podcasts by Dr. Sala. Visit exopoliticstoday.com.